Alrighty. So this is some work I did with a bunch of people, many of them here. Alrighty. So I thank everyone for their collaborations, contributions. This is a really collaborative effort. Obviously, a lot of people. It went very smoothly. So same disclosure, obviously, that this is not representing any of the views of the federal government, and it's just some work we did that before I was even appointed. Alrighty, and then same disclosures here. I'm funded by NIDA. My colleague, Dr. Jenna, the senior author on the paper, is funded by the Office of the Director at NIH. So the motivation for this paper, so overlapping surgery, I mean, anesthesiologists, we're all pretty familiar with what this is, but just maybe to make it clear, or just to review. So overlapping surgery is a situation where two or more procedures performed by the same surgeon are scheduled so that the start of one procedure overlaps with the end of the other. Another term that gets used a lot is concurrent surgery. So concurrent surgery is if the surgeon is performing, is in two rooms, and the key portions of the procedure are overlapping. So, and maybe the distinction is important because Medicare will not pay for a concurrent surgery, but it is fine with an overlapping surgery. Of course, the loophole there is what is a key portion of a procedure, and so that's at the surgeon's discretion. So you can imagine that's why there's some concern over this practice. A lot of attention in the popular press, I mean, this is sort of the big one at the Boston Globe, and no one from the hospital here, right? This made a lot of press. I guess not to name names, but I think there's another hospital in Washington, right? That was in Washington State. That was the subject of a lot of press about the practice. So it's received a lot of attention from the popular press. In response to those reports, the Senate Finance Committee had hearings on it, and so there's obviously a concern that if the surgeon's in more than one room at the same time, that might not be great for patients, right? It's probably important to remember, though, that overlapping surgery does allow for some benefits, right? So it allows more patients to get care from that surgeon. So we have to remember there are benefits. It's not like this is unequivocally a bad thing. But the key thing, of course, is the safety concerns and whether or not they're warranted, right? And so that's the purpose of the paper. So, before we all fall asleep. We basically looked at MPOG, about 60,000 cases, and the bottom line is that overall, overlapping surgery was not associated with worse outcomes. The differences that you see here are probably neither practically nor statistically significant. Cases are longer, about 30 minutes longer, and we did find some suggestions that it is associated with worse outcomes for higher risk patients and then for patients getting a CABG. So just a brief, it's only 10 minutes or 50 minutes, but a lot of work has been done on this before we did this paper, generally finding that it's a safe practice, but maybe some limitations, and again, I think these are limitations that MPOG is, again, uniquely designed to address. The first is small sample size, so many of these institutions done at a single surgery. Single institution, so for things like mortality, you're probably just not going to see effects. Many of them used an overly stringent definition of overlap. So if you use an overly stringent definition, which is like an overlapping case is 1 minute more of overlap, that's probably going to bias the estimate downwards because, you're including cases basically in overlap, but you're counting them as overlap cases. And I think the key one, and again, MPOG, this is, again, it contains data that allows us to address this, is that, they're comparing outcomes across surgeons, right? So they're basically comparing Dr. Jones, who does overlapping cases, to Dr. Smith, who doesn't. You might think that the surgeons who do overlapping surgery, though, are different from those who don't. They may be more experienced, for example. And so, again, that would tend to bias effects downwards. In fact, when we had done this paper, there had been a paper coming out looking at hip surgeries, and actually they found that, in fact, overlapping surgery was associated with worse outcomes when they compared outcomes within a surgeon. So it's sort of, what are some nice things that MPOG bears to bring on this question? I mean, I think that's for the purpose of this presentation, as we can talk about. And so there are almost no databases, really, that you could study this question. So that's one of the nice things about MPOG. Because if you think about what you need, well, the key one is surgical time. So that's really hard to find, right? I mean, most of my research actually is with administrative data, like claims data and stuff. But those claims data won't have surgical times. So the key thing is you have surgical times. You have surgeon identifiers, so NISQIP does have times, but I don't even know if NISQIP has times. It definitely won't give you the surgeon identifiers, at least not in the public data set. Data on outcomes, right? Mortality and then ICD codes that you can use to measure outcomes and risk adjustment. So it's everything that you're going to need. And then to address some of the other shortcomings, obviously there's going to be a large number of cases and multiple institutions, right? So again, MPOG is actually one of the few data sets that sort of was uniquely in a position to address this question. So some of the challenges as we kind of did this, so the key is that, yeah, I mean, you all know better than I am because I'm just not a tech guy, but the data are not consistently ported across institutions. So at the end of the day, for this study, we only really found 8 institutions that consistently reported those data elements that we needed. And the other issue is the difficulty identifying surgeries. So our initial plan is we were just going to take all the surgeries in MPOG, basically, and just adjust for surgery using the surgical CPT code. But we found that at the time, it was not really consistently reported. Now, since I think the reporting's gotten better, so we're doing another paper on whether surgeons fall asleep, and so we're going to use surgical CPT code, I think, for that one, because the reporting looks better. But back then, surgery, that was actually a big impediment, so it wasn't reported really very much at all. So we sort of made 2 changes to sort of our underlying statistical plan. So first is we restricted ourselves to 7 surgeries, so knees, hips, cranies, cabbages, and spine surgeries. And then how we identify them, the one thing that is we found consistently reported for just about every surgery is sort of that free text descriptor that a lot of the institution uses, so LTKA, left TKA, left knee replacement. And so the third on the paper, Chris Rischel, he's a computer scientist in addition to being an anesthesiologist, he wrote a script that kind of parsed those text descriptors. So we could identify those surgeries. So that's why we had to limit the number of surgeries, because it's easy to write a script that kind of looks for words, that looks for a knee replacement. It's much harder to write a script that kind of just takes the words and spits out what that surgery was. So that's why we sort of focused on those 7. So variables that these are just a list of variables we got from MPOG. Again, they're all, you all know the database, I think it's some a little better than I do, but they're all pretty standard things that you can get. So our inclusion criteria, so basically adults, not kids, people getting those 7 surgeries between 2010 and 2018. And so again, the big thing is that most institutions we found did not really report diagnosis codes consistently. So if you look at institutions that reported it for at least 70% of the cases they submitted, that's 8 institutions. Now with this falling asleep paper, I think it's up to 10. So. that does seem to be, diagnosis codes are important, right? Because we need them for risk adjustment and for complications. So sort of at the end of the day, of all the variables, if I had to pick, that's sort of, for our purposes, one of the ones we need the most. So about 90,000 cases initially when you kind of take the sample as previously described. And then if you throw out people missing data, the ASA score, we threw out people with an ASA of 6. That's mostly what that is. And then people getting more than 1 surgery type at the same time. And then finally, we kept ourselves to surgeon procedure combinations with at least 20 observations. So a final sample of about 66,000 patients. It's 207 surgeons and 373 surgeon procedure pairs. So basically, we used a little bit more stringent definition of overlapping surgery. So we said there had to be about 60 minutes of overlap with another surgeon to count it as an overlapping case, or if the case was less than 60 minutes, then the entirety of the case. The outcomes we used were in-hospital mortality, in-hospital complications, which we got from the diagnosis codes and surgery length. And so again, this is sort of just reiterating, the key thing we did is that we're not comparing Dr. Jones, who does overlapping cases, to Dr. Smith, who doesn't. What we're saying is within Dr. Smith, who happens to do overlapping surgery, some of the surgeries are not overlapping, and so we're comparing those to each other. So that gets at the issue of bias that you might get from comparing Dr. Jones to Dr. Smith. This first chart here is just to give you the range of the extent to which overlapping surgery occurs. So the y-axis goes from 0 to 50 percent of cases being overlapping. And then what we've done is we've plotted each institution. That's the letters that you see. And then the orange circle is the average. I'm a little bit surprised, actually. Knee replacement, as you can see, I would have thought that would have been one of the ones that was done most concurrently. But as you can see, it's the one that's always the left. It's actually one of the ones that, as things go, is done the least concurrently. This is obviously way too small as we see, but it's the sample characteristics. I'll just go over and give you the highlights. But basically, in general, there are a few differences between overlapping and non-overlapping cases, in particular age, sex, ASA score. Most of the comorbidities we looked at, where there were differences, the overlapping patients in general were feeling a little sicker, so 7 of the comorbidities were more common in overlapping cases, 2 were more common than non-overlapping cases. And so this is our findings on mortality. So I've just kind of highlighted. So our for all operations combined, a very small difference in mortality. It's not statistically significant, but I've highlighted for the subgroup analyses that we did. And so there's CABG and high-risk patients. And so there you can see, you know, difference about, 1.8 percentage points for CABG and a similar difference for high-risk patients for mortality. When you look at complications, it's pretty much the same story. So again, a very small difference for all surgeries combined, but subgroup analyses do show differences about 2 to 4 percentage points for CABG and high-risk patients. When you look at surgery times, I mean, basically, it's down the line. They're always longer by about half an hour. All right, so just the overall finding then is that overlapping surgery is generally, we think, pretty safe from this paper, but maybe caution further study in terms for your high-risk groups. So CABG patients, you obviously would think would be higher risk of all the surgeries looked at, and just in general patients with higher risk. It is associated with the case being about half an hour longer, so maybe some cost considerations. I don't really do work in that area, but I know some people here do, and if you take $30, $60 a minute as the cost of an OR, then that's not a trivial cost increase. All righty. Thank you.
So we were pretty obsessive compulsive about this data and how we handled it, expecting some amazing press deluge from the Boston Globe and things like that.
Oh, they ignored, by the way, it's interesting. The Boston Globe ignored this article. I found that intriguing.
So I was going to ask you, between your policy work in D.C. and being embroiled in a topic that you thought might have been a little bit higher controversy, any guidance for the group in terms of how to handle sensitive topics like surgeon identifiers? We masked all of them so you didn't see them. You didn't know which institutions were in this data set.
Right.
Issues where the privacy of MPAW got in the way, or areas where you were like, wow, I'm surprised you gave me that data. You probably shouldn't next
Well, I'm
time.
Surprised you gave me the data. And and you gave it again for our surgeons falling asleep papers. So we're surprised and thankful. I think the thing that helped, again, is masking identifiers. I think the other thing is we have surgeons on all these papers. So I think that helps.
Thanks, Eric. Great talk. From a clinical operations perspective, we see a lot of overlapping concurrent surgery with co-surgery types. So I'm wondering how you're handling this with the second study. Are you excluding cases with more than one primary surgeon, or identifying a primary?
Yes, for this study, we excluded more than one primary surgeon, although that's not a lot of cases getting excluded, frankly, least from this data set. Yeah, okay. For the surgeons falling asleep, same thing, but again, it's not that many. By the way, we're following up surgeons falling asleep with anesthesiologists falling asleep. So
I noticed that your exclusion criteria, any overlap of less than 60 minutes, you included that in your exclusion.
That's not exclusion. That's just if they overlap less than 60 minutes, they're not counted
because
as an overlapping case.
Frequently, we experience where the overlap is 20 or 30 minutes, and the case may only be an hour.
Yeah, so for our purposes, I guess part of the things is also not to be too original, so we use that definition because other studies have. So I agree with you, like 20 to 30 minutes on a one-hour case, could be significant. We did do a bunch of other studies. We did in the sensitivity analyses I didn't get to, we did lower these thresholds. It's pretty much what you think. So, for example, we considered sort of the standard threat. We didn't consider standard. We considered the threshold that other people did, which is like if it's an overlap for 1 minute, it's an overlap. And it's pretty much what you think, which is that the estimates start going towards no effect. Again, that's sort of which would argue against that, which would argue that those cases that we're now including, are for that overlap is not an issue in those cases.
And from a clerical perspective, the patient must be informed that the surgeon will be in overlapping cases.
Well, I mean that's actually the policy discussion. Yeah. I mean, I know that varies across institutions. Actually, if you look at sort of
CMS requires it.
The editorial that was written for this paper and some of the press stuff, I think that's where a lot of it was slanting. In fact, one of the things, I don't know if we cite in this paper or somewhere else, you'd be surprised how few patients know, actually. I think there's a paper that we came across. Most patients don't know.
Yeah. Thank you.
I just had a question about the surgical CPT codes, because I've been part of the enhanced observational study, and looking at the strings of some of the stuff where our not the free text, but what MPOG had given us for the procedure, it ended up being quite different than what the procedure really was. So I'm glad you used the free text. I thought that was fairly interesting, but most outcome studies use surgical CPT, and you put a whole bunch of them into a bucket. So are we moving to this now, or are we, what's happening with this? Because you found it a problem. You got around it with your texts, free text. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think other people are able to answer what we're doing with surgical CPT codes. I mean, the free text, it's nice because just about every case, it's actually one of the most consistently reported fields, period, right? I mean, next to age and sex like that, the free text is almost always there. That's nice, but, you know, the parsing is tough. The parsing, you have to know what the procedure is, and I'm sure it works well, but I'm sure the parsing makes mistakes as well, so, yeah.
Mike Burns, whose hair presented, I think, last at the SA, we've got in our quality metrics now, there's a machine learning algorithm applied to take the free text and create an anesthesia-based CPT code, and they're working on refining that to surgery or another diagnosis and things, but for now, we've got a predicted, or we think this was the surgery that was done, and they've actually found many cases where, even at our own hospital, where the code that we billed the patient under wasn't the surgery that we should have billed them under, and so we're finding some inaccuracies in our billing data, as you imagine. So the next version of this would benefit from what your quality metrics and research now gets, which is the predicted CPT code.
All right.